This starts with the multilateral development banks, and that's why, subject to reforms, we support a capital increase for the IBRD, the world's largest development bank and a key source of climate finance. And that's why next month I will lay before Parliament a UK guarantee for the Asian Development Bank, which will unlock $1.2 billion in climate finance from the bank for developing countries in the region. But impact is not simply a question of more creativity. To tackle systemic problems, we also need to reform the system itself. So, for example, we are co-chairing with the Dominican Republic the Green Climate Fund this year and driving forward reforms to speed up developing countries' access to it. But I've also heard our partners calling for international tax rules to work better for developing countries, for sustainable debt to be tackled more rapidly, and for obstacles that inhibit the flow of private capital to be addressed. My ambition here is clear: for the UK to lead the G7 debate on international institutional reform. Third, we must not just halt, but reverse the decline in biodiversity. Sometimes we become numb to the scale of the nature crisis. 1 million species facing extinction, including one-third of both marine mammals and coral reefs, and wildlife populations fallen by 69% since 1970, mostly due to a staggering 83% collapse in freshwater species. Biodiversity loss is as much a threat as changes to our climate. And with nature loss undermining progress towards the sustainable development goal, action on nature is also pivotal to genuine partnerships with the global south. We need to bolster the global effort to protect at least 30% of the planet's land and ocean by 2030. So we are completely committed to ratifying the High Seas Treaty and to securing agreement on a plastics treaty. And there I pay tribute to a predecessor, Zach Goldsmith, during his period in government. And I've been looking hard at the successes of our development programmes on nature. One programme has mobilised well over £1 billion to protect and restore forests across nearly 9 million hectares of land. And in the future, we plan to expand this programme in the Congo Basin rainforest, the second largest on the planet. Some of our funding has also been used for incredible research. Few would believe that thanks to the FCDO, a South African business is trialling new biodegradable nets that, if lost, leave no toxins or microplastics behind. I want many, many more examples like this. The SCDO spends around 5% of its development budget on research. And when I'm announcing today that we're starting to develop a new programme of research into nature and water specifically, with over 100 researchers and officials having just met in Kenya to begin this agenda. I'm also looking at how we deliver development programmes on the ground. Indigenous communities particularly are important in this regard. Like the incredible female sustainable business owners I met in the Amazon last year, nature's best custodians, and I'm very grateful to Conservation International for organising that trip. Nature has been declining 30% less and 30% more slowly in indigenous lands than in the world as a whole. Evidence shows that putting local communities at the centre of decision-making leads to better outcomes for the natural world. This is the model of development that I believe in, the modernised approach to development this government will be implementing, the spirit of partnership, not paternalism, in action. For me, this is deeply personal. far from here, in Guyana's rainforests, lie Sophia Point. I established this small conservation centre 5 years ago with my wife in one of the last unspoilt biodiversity hotspots in the world. It was fascinating and a huge privilege for me to discuss this with Sir David Attenborough last week and hear his reminiscence of visiting Guyana, the same rainforest, as a young man. I told Sir David that his first book, Zoo Quest for Guyana, which came out in 1956, which was the year that my father emigrated here to Britain. In fact, my father used to bring me to Kew Gardens. I mean, I look back, he's now not alive, so I can't ask him, but I now realise that the reason he brought me here was to somehow be in touch with Guyana and those rainforests. And we discussed how Sir David's work and that of Sophia Point is rooted in a concept common to indigenous people of that part of South America, and many farmers and others in Britain and around the globe, stewardship of the natural world. We have both an interest and a responsibility to maintain a livable planet for ourselves and for future generations. That is our goal. Ultimately, there will be no global stability without climate stability, and there will be no climate stability without a more equal partnership between the global north and the global south. For Britain to play its part, we must reset here at home and we must reconnect abroad. And that is what this government will deliver, so that together we can build a better future for all. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much. I think there are some questions. And the first on my list is Tom Clark.
Foreign Secretary, thank you. How are you going to deliver all of this with so little money? And what levers can you pull, bearing in mind that since the Paris Agreement was signed, I think more than $3 trillion have flowed from private banks, many of them British banks, into fossil fuels, more than $300 billion into unsustainable agricultural projects around the world?
Well, look, you're right to raise the issue. We have a $22 billion black hole. This is a tough fiscal environment. We're all aware of it. And in this country, you can see it with the state of our public services, particularly in the health service. We set out five important missions, and it's clear that growth is a central mission, and it's also clear that on climate, with GB Energy, with the National Wealth Fund, that is also a mission. And the transition that we're talking about, both for our country and as we partner with friends, colleagues, countries around the world, particularly in the global south, has got to be part of the story. We cannot have a situation in which the global north advance and leave the global south behind. So yes, it's a tough environment, and climate finance is going to be integral to that. But meeting the 11.6 billion remains our ambition as we undertake the spending review, and we'll consider all of those spending plans. And it's important that I and others within government continue to make the case, as of course government and Rachel Reeves makes those difficult choices about what our priorities are in a tough fiscal environment. But I think it's important to remember that this agenda is fundamental to UK growth, and therefore we should keep hope alive. Second question is from Professor Miles Allen.
Miles Allen, University of Oxford. You've rightly emphasised the vital role nature-based solutions play in addressing the climate crisis, but we can't turn rocks into trees forever. So I'd like to ask you about one thing you haven't talked about, which is geological net zero. In the scenarios that meet the goals of the Paris Agreement, we are putting carbon dioxide back into the Earth's crust at the same rate that we generate it from any remaining use of fossil fuels by mid-century. So as a physical reality, the world needs to get to geological net zero by permanent, safe disposal of carbon dioxide back into the Earth's crust. We in Britain have extraordinary resources to do this. Guyana needs the world, dare I say it, to reach geological net zero if Guyana is going to benefit from the extraordinary resources they've recently discovered. So there's a piece of history for the first country to commit to geological net zero. Are we going to take it?
Well, look, I think there's a debate there. My own view is to focus on the fact that it is a transition. I think against that transition, there is a role for carbon capture alongside all of that we want to do on renewables, particularly hydrogen's important as well. So we've got to get the balance right. But the point is you're transitioning away. So I hear what you say about geological net zero. That wasn't in my speech. I'll reflect on it, but I am conscious that we're in a transition and that's important to hold on to. The next question is Joe Lowe.
Hello, Joe Lowe from Climate Home News. You mentioned the NCQD talks. A lot of negotiators from developing countries have expressed frustration that developed countries haven't started talking about the quantum, the actual amount. What do you have any thoughts on what the amount should be, or at least when the UK will start putting forward proposals on that?
One of the words I've used in my speech today, and that I'd want to emphasise, is ambition. And I recognise the disjunct between rhetoric sometimes in the global north and the real pressing needs that exist in the global south as they look to see, is that rhetoric going to be actually matched with funds? So I want us to hold on to ambition here in the UK. And I talked about the connection geopolitically and why this is important. As I look around the world, particularly in democracies, there are some democracies, depending on where their elections go, who might move away from this agenda, which is why it's so important that we here in the UK now look to have stability, I hope for at least a decade, on this agenda and get back our climate leadership position. So I recognise what is being said, and I certainly feel very strongly about small island developing states particularly, who are on the front line and are disproportionately affected by the crisis that we're obviously all here to discuss. Let's be ambitious as we head particularly to COP29, which is focused on those developing countries. I can't make announcements here, because if I did, I'd go back to a storm with Rachel Reeves. And for all the reasons I've discussed, I'm not prepared to do that. But the point you make is a sound one. Then we've got Ed Davey, I think it is.
Thank you, Foreign Secretary. That was incredibly inspiring. Ed Davey, WRI. I'd like to start by saying I think you're dad, if he were here, would be incredibly proud to see his son speaking in this way here.
You're going to make me emotional. That's a very good start.
But Foreign Secretary, I hesitate to come back to money, but there was this incredible time when Britain really led the world on 0.7, under a Labour government, actually. And we know it's been difficult. And at some point, we believe we lost the British public on 0.7. But my colleague, Mozan Malik, who many of you know, has articulated recently that if Britain could come back to 0.7 or a commitment to it by 2030, and if 10 or other countries could do the same, suddenly we really could unlock a global trust again and a kind of global agreement around the kind of finance that needed on SDGs and 2030. So I'm wondering whether you feel in the geopolitics of the moment that you could persuade your cabinet colleagues and the government and the British people to get back towards that kind of goal by 2030. Thank you.
Well, I think it's a really good question. And, you know, Mohsen Malak is right to be challenging us to be ambitious once again in our objectives. And, you know, I feel very, very proud to have been part of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's government. I think back also to campaigns like Jubilee 2000 that really challenged the world on debt at that time. It depresses me hugely that those questions, particularly of debt, still hang over so much of the global south, even though, of course, the nature of that debt and the countries and private institutions to whom the debt is owed has changed a bit over the last 20, 25 years. But it connects to a theme of my speech, because what I wanted to do was what was always frustrated me. There are two things that frustrate me in the climate emergency debate. One is the way that the climate crisis and breakdown become siloed as a sort of separate thing that is a theme within politics but isn't actually at the centre of the political. And that's why I'm absolutely clear I'm centering this in security issues. So it is actually fundamental to the work of a foreign office like our own. And the other thing is that we here in Europe particularly lose the language of climate justice and of fairness, which should underpin this agenda. And I say that because, and I referred to this in my TED talk, for me, climate is not just the preserve of experts, scientists, temperature debate. It's more fundamental than that. And actually, if you know, within the tradition of my own political party, if you think of those working class communities that went down mines, often getting disease as a result, that is a justice issue. And it's why, when we talk about green jobs domestically, it's so important to centre those communities in that debate around climate justice. Well, in the end, the part of the reason that the funding has not been there is because climate has driven a migration crisis, and we've ended up in this place where we made a choice to spend development aid on housing people across the country and having a huge accommodation and hotel bill as a consequence. That was a choice. We are absolutely determined to turn that system around. It's not going to be something that we can do overnight, but the indication is that we want to get back to that 0.7 as quickly as possible. And of course, that's a discussion that I'm continuing to have with colleagues in the Treasury. Thank you very much for the question. I think we'll end there. Thank you very, very much. Oh, there's one more.
Thank you, Foreign Secretary. I'll grab the mic. Rob Merrick from the development website DevEx. I'll just ask you, this is my first chance to do so, about the wider development policy. You expressed an intention to for further integration between development and diplomacy within FCDO. And Labour obviously have said very different things in opposition. Can I ask you, have you decided to sort of intensify the merger, intensify integration, because it's too costly, too disruptive to try to give development greater independence? Or do you genuinely think it's the right thing to do, that you can get better development outcomes by intensifying the merger and integration?
I don't think I've ever used the language of intensifying the merger. That is interesting language that you've chosen, but it's your language, not mine. What I have said is that it's important that we have a review, because I do not think that we're where we should be in relation to the merger, and that's why I have asked Manoush to lead that review with her expertise. That's what I have said. And let me just say this, that I'm very conscious too that we are not in the same environment we were in when I last came into government back in 1997. This is a very different world. It's a world that's got to take on board China's Belt and Road Initiative. It's a world that's got to really face up to the ravishing of the climate crisis. And you see the effects of that particularly, I mean, here in Europe, you can see it in the Sahel particularly. And it's a world where we have to find the way to ensure that we have greater finance available beyond just taxpayers' pounds, effectively. So in that changed environment, it's hugely important that we do the work to make sure that the UK gets back its leadership role in this area. But it will be a different leadership mix to the leadership mix it was in 1997. And I've set out a substantial part of my speech explaining why that is the case. Thank you. Thank you very much.